they want to play the
sport. I like that. I call it that.
We'll call the meeting of the Environmental Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 27th. We have before us the... No. Excuse me. Today is Tuesday, March 28th. Okay. My bad.
Wednesday.
Because then I was going to have the minutes from the 27th approved as well. So it's Wednesday today, March 28th. I'm sorry. Some of the days are getting a little long here. Okay. Can we do a redo on the... Can we start over? Okay. Hey, Shorty. How are you? Okay. We have the minutes of March 27th before us. Representative Torkelson, would you please move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, move the minutes.
Okay. Any additions or corrections to the minutes as presented? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The minutes are approved. Okay. First up on our agenda for today, House File 4003. Representative Runbeck is here to talk about her enforcement of water appropriation permit conditions. So, to your bill, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to bring House File 4003 before you. This bill seeks a temporary delay in the settlement orders in the DNR White Bear Lake lawsuit that was settled last summer. This was a lawsuit brought by landowners because the lake had dropped to 919 feet from a high of 926 feet. It has risen back up, by the way, since the lawsuit was brought. It affects 500,000 people in the northeast suburbs, as well as many, many, many businesses. So it's an all-encompassing order. And I have brought with me, it affects 11 cities, I believe it is. So I have brought with me a city administrator, Brian Baer, from the city of Hugo, and he'll explain more to you about how the orders impact all of these folks.
Good morning, Mr. Baer. Would you introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Baer. I'm the city administrator from the city of Hugo. We've been implicated in this lawsuit. Not that we wanted to be. We have just been kind of brought into this lawsuit. So we are not the defendants. We are not the plaintiffs. We have just been impacted by the court order. So the court order in this case is to the DNR. When the DNR got the court order, they passed those orders on to the cities that are now impacted. There are 11 large permit holders that are cities impacted by this order, and it also impacts all of the cities that are served by those first 11. So in some cases, cities supply water to other cities. You have a map that is in your handout packet that will illustrate the impact of this. So there's a magic line that's created by the lawsuit about 5 miles around the edge of White Bear Lake. And if you have a well within that line, you're impacted by the lake. As you can imagine, water pipes extend to those wells and cross that line. So even residents that might be 6, 7, 8, 10 miles away from the lake can very well be impacted. So communities from St. Paul to Stillwater, from Lino Lakes to Lake Elmo, are all impacted if they're connected to a municipal supply or if they have their own well. The thing about this lawsuit is that its intention is to help restore the water levels in White Bear Lake. The problem with it is that while we would all like that to occur, that will not occur if this lawsuit is implemented. It can't happen. The things that are specifically ordered by the lawsuit will be counterproductive. A lot of us, Hugo included, are doing an extremely good job with very creative and productive measures to do a good job with water management, with excellent conservation strategies. Those strategies are not anticipated by the lawsuit, and in some cases this lawsuit makes it harder for us to keep doing a good job. If we were to implement the things that the lawsuit asks us to do, we think we will use more water instead of less. We're trying to do a good job here, but we're being very distracted by this lawsuit. The lawsuit, if we have to follow it, it will cost communities a lot of money and a lot of time to implement, and it will be very impactful on our residents and on our businesses. Even though they're being impacted, they cannot be assured that this will put water back in the lake. In fact, it may have the opposite effect. So I think I'll leave it there, at least for starters, and take questions, if that's okay.
Thank you. And with that, then, I'd like to move to re-refer House File 4003 to the General Register. And then we also have before us the DE2 amendment. Chair Funbeck, I'd move that for you.
Thank
so
you,
all those
Mr.
in
Chair.
Favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the amendment's adopted, and we now, members, make sure we're working off of the DE2. We have the bill before us. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments I'll be quick on is I support with where we were going with the DE2 amendment. I feel that it does a great job of narrowing things down to say we just stop enforcement efforts. It still does a lot of work to be done by the DNR in the other parts of the order, because currently the DNR is working on groundwater management area in this region. They're taking a look at doing things that will eventually cut back on water being used, etc. And so it allows those efforts to go forward, and that the DNR is doing other things that they normally would have been doing that is complying with the judge's effort. The other things I want to mention out is why I'm also supporting the bills. There's a couple of issues that come out as the judge's order said that the utilities are using groundwater have to connect up to a surface water or use a combination of surface and groundwater. But when taking a look at the area, that's the St. Paul Water Regional Water Utilities. They have their wells in the same area, and they're impacted by the same criteria that's out there. So this also impacts the cities of St. Paul, Lakewood, etc. And the St. Paul Water Utilities do not always pump from the ground. There's some years they do not pump at all. Other years only pumping to augment during the winter months as the water is flowing through from the Mississippi is having some issues with flow, etc. And so you've got an overreaching judge's order that's kind of impacting things. And another big thing that's that I feel is having an impact in this area is we heard about the PFC issue in our committee a week or so ago. One of the issues I asked is how much water was being pumped out of the Oakdale wells. The Oakdale wells were pumping out 950 million gallons a year. They are in this region right here. And so we've got some bigger issues out there I think that were kind of missed in the process and figuring out how does that impact some of these other areas. And I do know, having talked to the city manager there, is that one of the alternatives they have is they're a long way from the surface water utility. So they were looking at going into another region to connect with people that were in a little different aquifer to try to spread things out. They're doing a lot of with water reuse for their permits. They're a growing city, but the judges order bars them from doing anything outside of that area because those utilities are using aquifers to supply their wells in a different aquifer. So they're looking for different ways as remedies, but finding that the judge's order is limiting what they're able to do. And with as far as they are from the surface water, that could be about $600 million for them to build the treatment plant to get everything up there.
Thank you. Representative Wagini.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the mayor, I hear you disagree with the results of the lawsuit. That's clear. Were you one of the people that appealed the lawsuit?
Mr. Baer.
Thank you. We are not a part of the lawsuit, and so we are not in a position to appeal the lawsuit one way or the other. But the difficult part for the communities that are not part of the lawsuit is that this court order talks about water policy and gets into the areas of land use policy. And if we have a better way of managing our water resources at a better result, there's nowhere for us to go with that. We don't have a path to go to this judge. We don't have a path to find a better remedy. So an appeal is not a good answer for us. Now, when the DNR has ordered us to, has applied conditions directly to us, to our permit, we can appeal that. So we can appeal these new conditions that we're now subject to by the DNR. And that goes through a process with an administrative law judge. The problem for us and the other cities with appealing those permit conditions is that if we win those appeals, which we think we can. We think we can win. We don't know what we win, because we still have this district court judge that has ruled in the opposite way. And so it's a real dilemma, and there's nowhere really to go with this if we want to keep doing a good job with what we're doing. There's not a good alternative path.
Representative Joaquin, yes?
Well, basically, I mean, you do have appellate routes, but basically what you're asking this committee to do is understand the basis and all the science of a lawsuit that took months, where the judge made 149 findings of fact. It's one of the most complex orders, findings of fact, conclusions of law that I've ever read. And you're asking this committee to say, we understand the science, we understand the data better than the judge, and we're going to rule on it here. So I don't think it's appropriate at this point, Mr. Chair, for this committee to be entertaining this bill. But beyond that, I'm looking at some of the language of the bill. On 1.11, you say, Representative Rumbick, you say the commissioner may continue to use all the authorities granted under the statutes to manage groundwater resources within the north and east groundwater management areas. The implication to me of that, the way that's written, is that's the only place where the commissioner can manage groundwater resources, and that is should not be true. The other place I am looking, the commissioner, I mean, there are other groundwater management areas in the state, and there are other groundwater issues in the state. I have some in my own district with the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, and the management of those waters are impacting the basements of some of my constituents. But then I look at 1.18, where you're saying that the nobody is required to revise a water supply management plan to include contingency plans. This is a denial of the fact that there is huge water problems in the northeast quadrant of the metro area. Denying reality is not going to get us anyplace. We really have to embrace the science, embrace the data, and figure out what we're going to do, not come to the legislature and say, we just don't want to do anything right now. Mr. Chairman, I think this we should not be doing this bill. It is, we're in the middle of a court process, an appeals process, and it's just not a timely bill to be brought before the legislature. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, first of all, we have a date, a time certain, all right, so this is not a indefinite sort of a delay. Secondly, we're concerned about the unintended consequences that may even have perverse impact on water usage. Thirdly, there is the issue of the per capita aspect in the orders, which maybe Mr. Baer can go into. But then there's a concern, and we need to get in front of the issue of the torrent of lawsuits that will come about as a result of 11 different cities being affected in all of these ways and all of their businesses. So I think that the legislature has a duty to actually step in and intervene.
Thank you. And I would point out that in the bill it says temporary, and until July 1 of 2019 is the date down here. Representative Fisher, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be a question kind of directed to the city manager there. If you could tell us a little bit about what is happening in their efforts to address the water issues. I know that there's a lot of things that are happening there, realizing that there's water shortages. And maybe if you could explain a little bit as how you folks are what you're doing to make sure to comply to use water in a sustainable way up there.
Mr. Baird.
Thank you. So I won't cover the whole gamut of this, but very briefly, one of the most significant things that we do in the city of Hugo is we reuse stormwater. So what the court order asks us to do, in fact, is requiring there to be a residential irrigation ban put in place. And in the city of Hugo, we've already done the exact opposite, almost the exact opposite. We've been disconnecting our non-residential water users, our largest accounts, our very largest users, from our municipal system. We've been connecting them to stormwater users, to uses. And so instead of irrigating with drinking water from the ground, we're irrigating with stormwater. And by disconnecting these largest non-residential users, we're having a very, very significant impact. Tens of millions of gallons year after year after year that is not coming out of the ground anymore. When we do that, we also apply water to the ground and allow it to soak in and infiltrate and recharge the aquifer. We are infiltrating hundreds of millions of gallons of water back into the ground through our practices that help to recharge. None of these are anticipated or encouraged in any way by the lawsuit. The things that we're doing in Hugo are probably some of the best practices in the state. We're really, really good at this in the city of Hugo. And the residential irrigation ban is something that is very problematic to deal with, very expensive to try to enforce. We know that there's going to be a lot of pushback, and there's going to be a lot of loopholes. So there will be ways that people will figure out how to continue to irrigate, because the language in the court order is so vague, it's very difficult to manage. The second major thing that I would just reflect on is that is what Representative Runbeck indicated. The lawsuit also gets into this thing of per capita usage and regulating communities' per capita usage of water. And just think about that for a minute. There are better ways to handle this. If you start to regulate water on a total per person basis, there are big winners and losers. If you run a business, nobody lives at the business. This ends up being a de facto land use regulation where you have to discourage business to get under your cap. The alternative, the land uses that work really well under this formula are apartment complexes. The higher density, the higher the intensity of the land use, the more people you can squeeze into the building, the better, because you have more people that work great under the formula. Even if the apartment complex uses more water than the business, the apartment complex works in the formula and the business doesn't. This is not a water conservation strategy. The court process is not a good way to set this kind of policy in motion. And so I think that's the objective here, is to put this on hold, allow a pause, allow for the appeals to go out before we start spending a lot of money implementing these measures. That's probably the most impactful part of it.
Thank you. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so my district is greatly affected by this radius restriction as well. And I will note this is a very White Bear Lake centric map. It doesn't actually reflect all the other lakes at all. And I do appreciate the local efforts. You know, I know Shoreview and some of the other cities that I represent are trying to be proactive in dealing with these water issues. My concern is just, you know, if there this episode of the legislature should maybe be titled Separation of Powers. And I think that that's, it's just a little troubling to be involving ourselves in this way, so specifically aimed at a court process that's currently going on. I mean, I agree that this current way things are set up is not working for our cities. I'm just not sure that this is the way to get the relief that we need. I'm also concerned that it's the language of a court order issued in 2017 could be referring to 50 different court orders And it's that language is a little concerning because it's we don't have one. We don't have the court orders in front of us, and it, I mean that's really broad to use that type of language. So those are my concerns, but I do thank you for trying to address this issue because obviously it's a problem, especially where we've got more development further north.
Next, did you have a comment, Rumbeck?
Mr. Chair, I think just a comment that the passage of the bill would not impact or interfere with any appeals that the DNR may be pursuing. So we are not, in impeding that.
Thank you. I'd like to get Brian McGedrick. Is it McGoldrick? Excuse me.
In the effort of time, Shannon Whitaker
McGailey
is going to be Whitaker.
Thank you. Ms. McNeely Whitaker.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank
you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to the last comment.
Sure.
And I appreciate the Representative Brunbeck making that point, but it still doesn't. I mean, we're keeping the DNR from enforcing anything that's resulted based on a court order issued in 2017. So I just might want to look at tightening up the language so it's specific which problem you're trying to fix with this bill. So thank you.
I'd like to ask. Okay, Ms. McNeely Whitaker, your testimony, please. Identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name's Shannon Whitaker, and I'm a member of the White Bear Lake Restoration Association. Thank you for allowing me to speak today on behalf of our nonprofit that brought the lawsuit. It was not a group of homeowners that brought the lawsuit against the DNR for the MIRA statute violations, the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act violations. In the case of White Bear Lake, we have over 1,000 members in our organization locally, across the metro, and across the country. I consider myself fairly connected through the 5 years I've been working on this case and this nonprofit to knowing what's going on about White Bear Lake and issues surrounding it. I was made aware of this bill late last week, and I think I've heard from others that nobody has come up in stating some opposition to the bill, but notification has been short. In fact, our local White Bear Press is just coming out today with an article on the bill that's in front of you to vote in the next, I think, 24 hours. So the turnaround for us to be us and people wanting to testify against this bill has been short in order. As many of you have said, there is a very deep record for this case, deep science, and a long judge's order. And I want to state right now that I am aware of many of the efforts Hugo is undertaking as a city and other cities that testified during the 18-day court process. And there are many good efforts, and there is more latitude in the judge's order to meet some of the goals and the standards that are laid out than maybe have been presented today. Other than rain and the natural water cycle, the only identified cause of the water depletion is White Bear Lake, and the secondary cause is high-capacity municipal water pumping. And that has been proven in 4 studies, the first in 1998, the second in 2004, the third in 2012, and the fourth in 2016. All those studies have been commissioned by the DNR, and they all point to the same science. And now they're using modeling and more sophisticated methods that prove even in a one or two dry years, the impact of pumping on White Bear Lake can drop the lake a foot and a half in one season. This was never about interfering with water supply. This is about protecting a natural resource. That natural resource happens to be the bellwether for the Northeast Metro area on the health of not only surface waters, but groundwater, aquifer water. Because it has been defined that White Bear Lake is a highly vulnerable lake to groundwater and surface water exchange, meaning as draws on the groundwater increase, the White Bear Lake water level will be the first indicator that our aquifers are being depleted. One study shows at current use in the Northeast Metro area, without any increase for population, by the year 2030, which is 12 years from now, the aquifer will be at a 50% or lower level at current rate of pumping. That doesn't factor any other increases. So given all that, there is an appropriateness to the order from Judge Marinan in Ramsey County. And I also feel there is an appropriateness to having the legal process, which has had taxpayer and private citizen dollars invested over the last 5 years, run its course through whatever process that may be, without interference, respectfully, from another legislative or administrative body of the government.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Well, to the, I had my hand up before, but I just want to the witness, I appreciate your testimony. It is correct. And I particularly like your saying that White Bear Lake is going to be a bellwether for us on both groundwater and surface water. And thank you for stating your case. You did a good job.
Thank you. Rick, excuse me, Representative Castle, I'm sorry.
Call me Dan. And Mr. Chair, I know it's hard to see me down here. Mr. Chair, when, by the way, are the,
new, short chair today.
Are the new chairs coming, Mr. Chair? My question was, is DNR here to provide comment or perhaps Met Council?
I don't know. They didn't sign up to testify.
I'd like to hear their opinion on.
Okay. You phoned your friend.
Mr. Chairman, identify yourself for the record, please.
Members for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and Representative Hansen, committee members. I really can't comment on this issue right now. We're in the middle of an appeal process and waiting to hear back on that. So with that, I have nothing to say.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's kind of what I thought you'd say, is because we're in the middle of a court battle here. And again, the legislative branch is intervening. And I'm old enough to remember when we wouldn't do that on a bipartisan basis, that we wouldn't get in the middle of that. So I just wanted you to have that on the record that you can't. And, you know, we just keep stepping into areas that we historically haven't. I don't know, is there anyone, Mr. Chair, here from Met Council or anyone else who can, maybe he's not a party or is a party, can comment?
No one else signed up to testify, Representative. So if no more questions, Representative Virginia.
Thank you. Representative Rundbeck, you said that this is only a temporary order.
Could you please speak into your mic?
Okay. Until July 1, 2019, but that appears to me to only apply to Section 1.
It's Section 2 that I am equally concerned about, where you say that communities are not required to revise water supply plans to include contingency plans. And that appears to be to be ongoing. And so we have drafting problems as well as legal issues here. And I just want to note for the record, it's my understanding, and here's the problem here, members. None of us have, maybe I've read the court order, but most of us have not read the court order. We have not heard the testimony about the science. We haven't heard from USGS, for example, who did all of the science that is being relied upon in the court order. So I don't think we have any business here, but I would point out in the testimony of the mayor of Hugo, he talked about water going back into the aquifer under Hugo, but it's my recollection, I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that Hugo did not have enough water in its aquifer and had to do a pipe wanted to do a pipe 4 miles away to get to another aquifer for the water for Hugo.
Mr. Baer, if you'd like to go ahead and respond.
Thank you. The city has worked hard on this water management issue. We have been as creative as we can think about how to be. We have proposed connecting our water supplies to other water suppliers near us. We do not have to do that. We have plenty of room under our appropriation to continue to pump groundwater. There's not a question about whether we are going to run out of drinking water in the city of Hugo. But as an effort to do a good job with water management, we have worked to try to connect to other cities. We know that with all of the science that's being talked about, the one thing that we know is that the science cannot connect our wells in Hugo to the lake. It doesn't work that way. We cannot help this lake by shutting off all of our wells, sealing them up. That is not going to influence the lake level. Despite all of that, if we want to cooperate with our neighboring communities right now and extend pipes to them, the court order makes it extremely difficult for us to do that. Because if they connect their water supplies to ours, now our water's mixed together. And when our water's mixed together, those communities are now subject to the same restrictions that we are. This idea that we can do a good job in collaborating and finding different water supplies is inhibited by the court order. If we have a better water supply someplace else, we might also not be able to get to it if it isn't a surface water supply, because the court is ordering us to find a surface water supply. That costs us $623 million to do. If we have a good groundwater supply someplace else, court order doesn't let us connect to it. It is a very short-sighted and prohibitively difficult thing to work underneath of. And there are better, more responsible ways for us to deal with it. But there is not a four-mile pipeline or something like that that we are working to try to get constructed.
So
we got a heavy schedule today. Representative Rumbach, right. Do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want the committee members to think about all the thousands of lakes in Minnesota and the kind of precedent that a situation like this portends, and that we are looking for legislative remedies, we are looking for municipal remedies, and this is where these kinds of water supply laws need to be made, not in the court. I appreciate your support.
All right. Members, I would then move to re-refer House File 4003 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay. No.
It is re-referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brooks. I'm assuming you can move your bill.
I'm not sure of the motion, Mr. Chair.
All right. I would go ahead and move to re-refer House File 3960 to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment to get the shape, the bill in the shape I would like. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Right.
Aye. Opposed, nay. All right. Sounds like the bill is in the shape that you want, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. The amendment put this language in the identical form that was passed in the bill yesterday as part of yesterday's bill. I'm sure members remember the discussion we had about this issue at that time. I know we're short of time. I'm just going to briefly review how we got here. Of course, the letter of the commissioner was issued some time ago, and when that letter came out, the Legislative Water Commission, of which I'm a co-chair, realized that this was an important initiative and that we would endorse it with our work. The Legislative Water Commission is a 12-member commission that some of you are familiar with. Representative Fisher serves on it. It's bicameral, bipartisan. It's evenly divided. We're so evenly divided we couldn't pick a chair. We had to pick co-chairs, one from the Senate, one from the House, and one from each party. My co-chair, Senator Wieger, is with us today. And at the end of our work, we spent a lot of time this interim, some lengthy meetings, talking about wastewater and the issues surrounding wastewater and permitting. And that after that process, we tried to reach some conclusions that we could agree upon a bipartisan and bicameral nature. And one of those recommendations was to place the language of the commissioner's memorandum into statute. And that's exactly what this bill does. I do think we should probably just talk a little bit about peer review. I don't know how much time we want to spend on it today, but peer review is really done by scientific experts. It's not done by people from any particular interest group. And bringing the peer review process earlier into the process of creating these new standards certainly is appropriate because it can make them a much better result for the state of Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair, I know we're short of time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Looks like we have a testifier, Representative, so I think...
I do have a testifier. Good morning.
I think you know the drill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greta Gothier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Very briefly, we had a pretty thorough discussion on peer review yesterday. The MPCA participated in the stakeholder group before the Legislative Water Commission all through the summer and the fall of last year. And so the commissioner is fine with putting his commissioner's order from July of 2017 into statute. And is fine with the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take questions.
All right. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gothier, my question is, will this slow down the permitting process?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, well, this is peer review for a water quality standard. So the standard is the goal, and then the permits are the individual ways we try to meet the goal. So it does add a layer of review to our work, but the commissioner felt that with the concern about peer review in recent years, even though we use only peer-reviewed information in putting together our water quality standards, that it made sense to do the peer review at the beginning of the process on the technical support document, which is the starting point, really, of our rulemaking when we do new water quality standards.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked the question inappropriately. Will this slow down that work, the developing the standards?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, yes, it will take more time, but we feel that if we have a good panel of peer reviewers, you know, scientific experts in this area from around the country or around the world for that matter, take a look at our work very early on, then there will be more confidence and assurance for the public that we're on the right track.
Representative Duffy.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll just make my comments now. And I wish Representative Fabian were here. If you recall my question yesterday about the value of separating out identifiable parts of the chamber bill and working on those. And I want to thank the chair for doing that. I'll give you the credit, Representative Heisman. You're at the helm today. But I think that's really what I was talking about. And I think this bill is a good example of a couple of things. One is that we did show the capacity. The state of Minnesota showed the capacity to work together. This was both in terms of the executive and the legislature working together, and also the legislature itself working together, as Representative Torkelson identified in a bipartisan way. I really think that's what Minnesotans are looking for. So this bill, I think, is an example of that. And we've listened, we've worked hard on this subject, and this bill came out of that hard work. I also, one last comment, I also think it demonstrates the value of the Legislative Water Commission. The last several years, we've had to struggle to keep funding for to keep the Legislative Water Commission alive and keep it going. And yet, this is an example where the Legislative Water Commission was a vehicle for Minnesotans to come together on a contentious issue and come to a reasonable compromise. So my compliments to the work I'm proud to be part of the Legislative Water Commission that did this, but also my sincere compliments to the MPCA for working alongside us on this. And it's good news for Minnesota.
All right, members, if no more questions, Representative Torkelson. Representative Pan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to provide a contrary view of this, we had the same comments yesterday. I think that we'll be able to judge this based on the outcome of it, which maybe we have to check back 5, 10, 20 years from now and see if any water quality standards are ever set. You know, Minnesotans should know that we have interests now that develop think tanks, a variety of think tanks that have the perception of being scientific entities, which are actually lobbying fronts that engage on issues under the cloud of being scientific entities. I'm sure that they will be engaged in this as is happening apparently nationally as well. So as I said yesterday, I think this sets up a perpetual peer review process. We'll see if water quality standards actually get set. You know, obviously, I think this is going to probably become law, but the outcome we won't be able to tell for quite some time.
Representative Torkelson, we'll try again. Do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just appreciate the work of the Legislative Water Commission. I neglected to mention Representative Johnson's name in my opening remarks, and I apologize for that. He is also a member of the commission. You know, peer review has always been a part of the process. Adding this earlier in the process could, in some cases, actually speed up the process because there'd be less controversy at the end. You know, the peer reviewers are selected by the department, and to insinuate that somehow we're trying to weaken the process or make it less effective is just not right. We're trying to make this work better and more effectively so that at the end of the day we have standards that actually are less controversial and improve our water quality in a way that is good for all of Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair, I hope you can renew your motion.
I will do that. I will move to re-refer House File 3960 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
It's re-refer.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator Backer, I will move to re-refer House File 3441 to the General Register. And if you'd like, I will also move your DE1 amendment at this time.
I would appreciate that, Chair and Member.
So, members, you have the DE1 amendment before you. I would move DE1. All those in favor of the DE1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment's adopted. Representative Backer, through your amended bill.
Yes, the stakeholders have worked together to come up with the DE1 amendment, which you will hear today with the testifiers that there's pretty much peace in the valley, as much peace we can get. It does exempt temporary storage facilities located at dry bulk agriculture commodity facilities. This would include grain elevators, ethanol plants with fugitive dust emission limits contained in the Minnesota rules, and then provided that the temporary storage facilities are moving the biodegradable corn dust with portable equipment. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Miller, would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent? Proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mick Miller, General Manager of the Ethanol Processing Facility in Morris, Minnesota. The amended language is simply just further clarifying the definition of what temporary storage facilities are and also portable equipment. And in summary, we're using temporary storage facilities as a surge capacitor to hold grain, specifically corn, in our instance, during the harvest period. So there is regulation at the state level that restricts the amount of dust or opacity that can be emitted from the temporary storage facility or the portable equipment. And our efforts were to try to work with the state to make the state regulations consistent with the federal regulation. And the amended language is offered up in conjunction or, you know, working relationship with the MPCA. So we're certainly appreciative of their efforts. The new language is definitely a reflection of the MPCA working with us to come up with a comparable solution that we both sides agree with.
Thank you. Jeff Smith. Where is he hiding?
There he is.
Oh, you changed your mind. Mr. Barton's here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Identify yourself, please.
David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. Everything you heard is true. We thank the author for listening to us. We especially thank Mr. Miller for working with us. He's made several drives from Morris over the last couple of weeks, which is a sacrifice, and we're satisfied with the language. We're happily neutral.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Backer, you mentioned stakeholders had worked on this. Were the employees or any of the grain handlers union, were they involved as stakeholders, people who are working in those facilities? That's one question. And then the second is, how about municipalities where these facilities may be located either within or near?
Representative Backer.
Okay, yeah. Chair and Representative Hansen. First of all, yes, I have talked to the city manager, Blaine Hill, in regards with Morris. He has received zero complaints from his office at all. So we had this lively discussion in ag policy. A lot of questions were asked, and we had other testifiers. What I'm referring to the stakeholders is I was asked to carry this bill that represents the district that I serve, so I've been working with the local stakeholders locally, so I should have clarified that was the local stakeholders. And again, we've worked with MPCA on this and have found a neutral agreement on it, and that's always good to work it out.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Backer, I appreciate that you're working with your local community, but the law would affect the whole state. So I'm wondering if the League of Cities or the League of Small Cities maybe or any of the other local communities where there may be residences nearby had the opportunity to weigh in. And then, again, on the actual workers who are working in these facilities, if they've had the opportunity to provide input.
Well, the League of Cities and Small Cities have lots of people present around this building, and they have not signed up to testify. Yeah. Representative Wagenius. Representative Backer, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I actually asked Representative Backer a question.
I concur with Chair Fabian, per se. I know Mick Miller and their lobbyists has worked extremely on this bill to find a common ground because, quite frankly, we're talking about biodegradable dust that's here. It's part of rural Minnesota. I live in Browns Valley, Minnesota, and in the harvest time, we get dust in the air. It's like snow in Minnesota. So we just have to have some common sense followed by science. This is biodegradable dust, and Mick Miller has worked really hard with the individuals locally, and this is how this came up, and you can also go ahead.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, I'm well aware of corn dust and how that works. The question is, so the workers that are there as a place of employment, they're working where there's fugitive dust, and the residences that may not be Morris, so let's say an unnamed town, they don't have a choice. If you have, you know, their home is there where they may be, and it does get in people's lungs, and some people may react to that. Some people may be allergic to that corn dust. And so that's the question of how, and again, it's not an all or nothing. It's not, I'm trying to make sure we've had some opportunity for those folks who may have exposure that may have a reaction, either because of their employment or because of their locality of their residence.
You want to address that?
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this language only applies to temporary storage facilities, which are basically corn bunkers, and they are used approximately 1 to maybe 3 weeks out of the year. So, and it's not a given that they're used every year. They are specifically designed to handle surges of grain during the harvest season when the farmers are busy, and if there's adequate supplies, it needs a home. To comment on our employees, yes, working at a grain elevator or an ethanol facility, you will be from time to time exposed to dust. We supply all the necessary personal protective equipment for those folks during those periods. But you know, I think the biggest point is they are temporary. We've been in existence 19 years. Our bunker's been in place for about 10 years, and we've filled it about 6 or 7 of the 10 years. So it's not even every year that it's utilized. It's dependent on the local conditions.
Representative
Wagner. Thank you. Since I'm not, don't sit on the Ag Committee, I'm going to follow up on Representative Hansen's question. We've heard from PCA that they're fine with this change, but there seems to be a health implication here. Have you worked with the Department of Health?
Representative Backer. Chair, no, I have not personally worked with the Department of Health, no.
Representative Wagner, yes.
Are there health implications from this change?
Representative Backer.
Not that I'm aware of. I've lived in a rural community. I volunteered as an EMT, and we never had a 911 call because of corn dust.
Representative Wagner.
Well, you wouldn't have a 911 call because of coal dust getting into people's lungs either. It's not a 911 issue. It's a long-term issue. And so I just wanted to know if you had talk to the Department of Health. Apparently not. I think that is something that should be done.
Nick Miller. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in relation to health issues or concerns, please note we are still subject to the federal standards and the Clean Air Act, and we've performed thousands of dollars in what's called dispersion modeling to prove that we're in compliance at the federal level to ensure that the public health of both our employees and neighboring members in the community are in a safe condition and a safe environment. So it's not, this bill doesn't change anything with respect to not having regulation over us. It simply clarifies the temporary storage and portable equipment has been determined by EPA. You specifically cannot physically control dust that would come off of a front end loader when it scoops into a grain pile and loads that grain into a truck so it can be transported. So from a federal or EPA standard, there's certainly regulation and compliance standards that we're still subject to and are abiding by.
Thank you. Representative Wagner. Yes.
Okay.
All right. Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just make a comment. I sat in the Agriculture Committee, and I'm glad to see the resolution that came through the MPCA and on this bill. And just frankly, the reality is we produce a lot of corn in Minnesota, and that's a tremendous asset for this state on many, many levels. And it's central to our economy, and it comes right at the same time. And the reality is we've got to put that corn someplace. And so these temporary facilities are scattered across Minnesota. When I drive by them, I see an asset to Minnesota. And yes, we have to get better. We ought to be smart about making sure that the impact of that is minimized as much as possible. But this is a temporary situation. It really reflects just the realities of the harvest. So thanks for all involved for coming to this agreement. It's a step forward.
Thank you. It's a good common sense piece of legislation. Thank you, Representative Backer, for bringing it forward. We could talk about a canola crushing plant in northwest Minnesota too today, but we won't do that. So with that, final comments on your bill.
We appreciate your support. Thank you, members.
Thank you. So with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 3441 to the General Register, as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
No.
The bill's moving to the General Register. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Next, we have Representative Heintzman with House File 3352.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
We are
one step to go to Ways and Means.
Yes.
So I will move to re-refer House File 3352 to Ways and Means Committee. So Representative Heintzman, do a walkthrough on the bill, please. I see you've got the expert with you.
I have a little help with me.
Yep, that's good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Nett.
I'm going to go ahead and do we have a couple of amendments to work on, or we want to do the walkthrough first?
Mm-hmm. Walkthrough first, please.
Yourself.
Although it is your bill.
Good morning, yes, members. I am Becca Nash. I'm the new staff director of the LCCMR, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to present on House File 3352. As a reminder, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund is a permanent fund in the state treasury. It was created through constitutional amendment to support activities to protect, restore, conserve, preserve, and enhance Minnesota's air, land, water, fisheries, and wildlife resources. It's funded with proceeds from the Minnesota State Lottery, as well as from investments managed by the State Board of Investment. LCCMR is responsible for making Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund recommendations to the legislature, and then for oversight of the approved projects and associated expenditures. As many of you know, LCCMR is a 17-member body made up of 5 senators, 5 representatives, and 7 citizens, and we have included in your packets a list of the current LCCMR members. The LCCMR is assisted by staff who are here with me today, Michael McDonough and Michael Varian, as well as Diana Griffith, who is back in the office. So I'm going to do a walkthrough of the bill, but first I want to draw your attention to a couple of the handouts in your packets, starting with the handout with the pie chart. This just provides a schedule of the process. It's a multi-step competitive process that the commission goes through in evaluating proposals. This is what led to the recommendations that are before you today. The table in the middle of the page, as well as the pie chart on the first page, provides a breakdown of the number of recommendations and the dollar amount of those recommendations per LCCMR priority category. I'll talk about those categories in a moment, but they do correlate to the subdivisions in the bill. On the second page is a breakdown of the project proposers, so this is where the money would go if funded, and then at the bottom is a pie chart showing the impact of those projects through the state. The second handout I just want to point out is the one with the pictures on it. This is a narrative summary of all the projects, and then again, it is grouped by subdivision. The third handout is a list of all the projects in the bill, all the appropriations in the bill. It's listed by title, dollar amount, organization, program manager, and impact in the state, and I recommend you use this as we go through the walkthrough for the appropriations. The bill also, in addition to the appropriations, includes 2 proposed statute changes, some changes to previous year appropriations, and some carry forwards. I will start, however, with the appropriations, which is Section 2 of the bill, starting with Subdivision 3, which is foundational natural resource data and information. This is $7,293,000, 12 recommendations representing about 16% of the funding. These are projects that primarily involve collection, analysis, mapping, and dissemination of foundational data and information needed for conservation planning and decision making. Examples in this category include 3A and 3B, continued funding for the County Geologic Atlas, which provides information needed for sustainable management of Minnesota's groundwater and drinking water resources. Another example is 3G, using foundational data to create an early warning system for wildlife health threats in Minnesota. Subdivision 4 is water resources. These projects include research and demonstration projects, as well as efforts on development of new techniques and technologies to increase the protection of the quality and quantity of Minnesota's water resources. Examples include 4A, a pilot program to optimize local mechanical and pond wastewater treatment systems. This is a partnership with the Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Rural Waters Association, and the University of Minnesota's MNTAP Technical Assistance Program. And the idea is to increase nutrient removal and improve efficiency of existing treatment systems without requiring costly upgrades. Also in this category is Project 4C, which aims to reduce fluorides in our water bodies through evaluation of road salt and pavement alternatives. Subdivision 5 is technical assistance, outreach, environmental education. This is $5,168,000, 12 recommendations representing about 11% of the total funds. This category includes outdoor experiences and hands-on youth education in such things as aquatic biology, outdoor leadership, and watershed stewardship. Examples include 5B, yes, students take on Minnesota Water Quality Challenge, and 5C, the Get Outdoors Minnesota After School Program, which aims to incorporate outdoor nature activities in after school programs, especially for underprivileged children. Subdivision 6 is aquatic and terrestrial invasive species. $5,760,000, 6 recommendations representing 13% of the funds. This category includes research, development, demonstration, and education projects to prevent, reduce, or control invasive species. Example projects include 6A, continued funding for the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center, 6C, evaluating methods to control invasive hybrid cattails in Voyageurs National Park, and 6E, installing a carp deterrent on the Mississippi River Lock and Dam. 7C, subdivision 7C, is air quality and renewable energy. This is $1.2 million, 3 recommendations representing 3% of the funds. This category includes projects 7A and 7C, which use innovations in materials and manufacturing techniques to improve renewable energy efficiencies, and project 7B, which is demonstration of community-scale energy storage. Subdivision 8 is methods to protect or restore land, water, and habitat. This is $3,119,000, 8 recommendations representing about 7% of the funds. This category includes innovations in the way we go about protecting or restoring our resources. Example projects include 8A, acceleration of the state's non-game wildlife program, with a new emphasis on nature tourism, and a project called Heart of the Bog, Birding and Wildlife Trail, that would extend across 4 counties in northern Minnesota. Another example is 8B, development of a biomulch to replace plastic soil covering in vegetable and fruit production to increase yields and reduce waste. Subdivision 9 is land acquisition, habitat, and recreation. This is $17,439,000, 12 recommendations representing 38% of the funding. Projects in this category include development and enhancement of several state and regional trails, including 9D, the Mississippi Bluffland State Trail in Red Wing, 9C, the locally spearheaded Harmony State Trail Extension in Fillmore County, and support for 9A, the state's local parks, trails, and natural areas grants program. This also includes fee title and conservation easement acquisition, as well as restoration. Example of those include 9H, protecting the north central Minnesota lakes through rim easements, as well as 9J, protecting the last remaining native prairie in the state through prairie bank easements. Subdivision 10 is the emerging issues account. This is $439,000, one recommendation representing less than 1% of the funds. This is for funding projects that come up unexpectedly between LCCMR funding cycles, but which still adhere to the Commission's strategic plan. In the past, this has been used for such issues as harmful algal blooms, Palmer amaranth detection and eradication, and chronic wasting disease. I'm going to propose skipping subdivision 11 for now. We'll pick it back up when we transfer over to the bill in a moment. I just want to finish up with the other appropriations in subdivision 12, which is contract reimbursement. This is $135,000, one recommendation, and this is for fiscal management for non-state entities receiving funds. So any of the state agencies who are receiving funds through this bill, it's a direct appropriation, but if it's a non-state agency, they have to go through a contract with DNR, and so we pay DNR to do that contract work and fiscal oversight. Now I would like to switch to the bill itself and pick up back up with subdivision 11, which starts on page 26. LCCMR, this is wastewater treatment system recommendations. This is for $0. So LCCMR is not recommending funding this fiscal year for wastewater treatment systems. There is language in the bill, however, that does two things. Subdivision 11A, wastewater treatment system grants, commits LCCMR until June 30th, 2021 to consider recommending up to $10 million to match bonding appropriations that exceed $10 million per year. These dollars would be used by the Public Facilities Authority for wastewater treatment grants to cities and towns with a population under 5,000. This would be as part of the PFA's Water Infrastructure Funding Program and their Point Source Implementation Grant Program. This is connected to a proposed statute change that occurs later on in the bill. And the second thing this language does is in Subdivision 11B, Wastewater Treatment System Loans, and this commits LCCMR to consider recommending up to 5% of the corpus of the trust fund as loans to the PFA, which in turn would issue loans to cities and towns with a population under 5,000 and as part of their clean water revolving fund. The loan principal and interest would be paid back to the trust fund corpus. This is currently allowed under our Constitution, but it would require a statute change to make the interest rate in line with PFA's current loaning practices. So we'll get to that statute as well in a moment. Then subdivisions 13 through 19 in the bill are all conditions of funding that typically get included in our bill as rider language. So this is standard LCCMR language. It should not be surprising. Most of you have seen this before. Subdivision 20 is carry forwards and extensions. These are projects that for one reason or another just need a little bit more time to complete their objectives. Most of them have already completed significant work objectives. They just need a little bit more time to finish their final objectives. Okay, and then moving on to Section 3 of the bill. This is starting on page 37, line 13. And this includes the first recommended amendment to statute that I referenced earlier with regards to the wastewater treatment funding. This change would be to Statute 116P, which is LCCMR's governing statute. Currently, money from the trust fund cannot be spent for municipal water pollution control. With the amendment shown, that restriction would be eased to allow for funds to be spent on water pollution control in municipalities with populations less than 5,000. Section 4 of the bill includes the second amendment to statute. This is also to 116P, and this is changing the interest rate calculation on any loans that would be made from the trust fund to the PFA, and then requiring the PFA to report back to the commission on any loans that they made. Section 5 of the bill includes two amendments to prior year's appropriation language. One, which is on page 40, affects the Native Prairie Bank project from last year. It's changing the amount of appropriation available for conservation easement stewardship. And then on the very last two pages of the bill. This is related to the appropriation for Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program last year. Similarly, it's allowing a portion of that appropriation to be used for stewardship of conservation easements acquired under that program. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Heitzman, your amendments?
So I have right here at the top, the A1, it's a technical amendment.
Ms. Taylor can probably explain the technical amendment.
Ms. Taylor, if you wouldn't mind.
Mr. Chair, members, the A1 is mostly technical. It's and including recommendations from LCCMR staff. Line 1.2 through 1.3 just pushes $89,000 into the first year, just so we don't exceed the constitutional amount that can be appropriated. Lines 1.5 through 1.10 would allow the use of income generated from two different projects to be reinvested in the program as long as they're that's specified in the work plan. Lines 1.11 and 1.13, this would allow a portion of the funds for the Native Prairie Bank appropriation to be used to set up a stewardship account. Line 1.14 is just a technical. 1.15 through 1.19 would add another carry forward for that project that you see there, and then the rest of it is just technical to accommodate that.
I will move the A1 amendment. Okay. All those in favor of the A1 signify. Oops, I'm sorry. Rick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we vote on anything, I need to do a disclosure. As we've done, as I've done on previous bills where there's been an appropriation online, on page 21, I want to disclose that I have property adjacent to that appropriation on 21.29.
Okay. Thank you. So I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The amendment's adopted. Next,
the A2.
I will move the A2 amendment. Those in favor of the A2. Oh, I'm sorry, explain the amendment.
There's a little bit there, so
yep,
I'm going to go.
There's quite a bit there.
This is county notification, members. When land purchases are being made with dollars from these funds, this would require that a county government would be notified of that purchase. Looks like Amy may have a clarification for the chair to maybe mention, but I'd like to go ahead and add this to my bill.
Representative Becker Finn. And I would add, too, that it's a town board. It's the same language, members, that we have in the Outdoor Heritage Bill. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to ask for clarification that this is not a recommendation of the LCCMR, but it's adding in that bill that we heard previously. Okay.
Okay, so just a clarification. Representative Heitzman, to that point, please.
Yes, this is mine. I'm adding this. This is not a recommendation of the LCCMR commissioners.
Okay, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think the committee had a debate on this with Outdoor Heritage. I would ask for a roll call on
that. Sure. Okay, any discussion? Okay, hearing a call for roll call on the A2 amendment, the chair votes aye. Oops, excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry.
In a little.
Chair votes aye. Heinzman?
Chair votes aye. Yep.
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Becker? Becker Finn?
No.
Bliss?
Yes.
Clark? Eklund?
Yes.
Fisher?
No.
Green?
Yes.
Coffey?
Yes.
Hornstein?
No.
Johnson? Brian?
Yes.
Johnson Clark?
No.
Lehman?
Yes.
Lewick?
Yes.
Metza? Neuberger?
Aye.
Hostin?
Yes.
Sundin?
No.
Swidzinski?
Yep.
Torkelson?
Aye.
Uglum?
Yes.
Wagenius?
No.
There being 14 ayes and 7 nays, the H amendment is adopted. Next, the A3.
Representative.
I believe that's Representative Eklund's amendment.
I'd like to move the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
This is a result of working with Representative Brooke and other people on the sulfate standard, and we want to work with the different tribal governments to do some wildlife restoration while that whole thing is being worked out, Mr. Chair.
Discussion to the amendment? Representative Lewick.
I want to thank Representative Eklund for offering the amendment. We've discussed this at some length, and I just want to again state that the work here I'm trying to shift the focus on restoration of wild, directly to restoration of wild rice is definitely a bipartisan effort. I'm sad to say Representative Metzi isn't here to add his support to this, but it is a bipartisan effort here to make sure we stay focused on really taking care of our wild rice beds.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, two things I just want to make it clear to the public and everybody here that I don't think this is, to my knowledge, the tribes have not, this isn't something they're asking for. This isn't some kind of quid pro quo agreement that's going on. I'm sure that, you know, any funding we can provide for this is helpful, but so there's not a perception that this is somehow something the tribes are asking for regarding the sulfate standard and that bill, because I don't see them here, and I certainly haven't heard from any of them. I don't know if Representative Eklund or Representative Lewick, you know, discussed any of this with them. And then second, and I don't know if there's technically what we do to make this change, but just want to clarify, and I did just mention this to Representative Eklund, that the current wording on 1.7 of Minnesota Chippewa, so 1.16 or 1.6 and 1.7 of bands of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, that leaves out Red Lake. And so just a clarification that the Minnesota Chippewa tribe bands does not include Red Lake. Their treaties and are different, and they're a separate. The laws that apply to them are separate. Each of the bands is their own nation, but Red Lake doesn't fall under the Minnesota Chippewa tribe technically. So want to clarify that, you know, maybe if there's a way to change that. I don't know if we can do that, how we would do that here, or if we would have to do it later, but clarifying, you know, for maybe for competitive grants to tribal governments, Minnesota tribal governments might be a better way
sure.
to word that.
Representative Eklund wanted to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Becker-Finn is correct. This is not a quid pro quo thing or anything like that, but Representative Metz and I did talk to the tribal governments about what we're going to try to do as far as funding goes. So they're aware of it. We're not asking them to buy in or not. We just thought it might be, while this thing was going forward, that it might be a good way to work on other projects for rice restoration.
And we can continue to work on the language and ways and means. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is a question for Mr. Hegemeyer on where the dollars would come from, the $400,000. Is that money on the bottom line, or is there emerging issues, or where are the funds there? Have there been cancellations?
Mr. Hegemeyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, if you look on line 1.12 of the amendment, that it reduces the amount in the that would be going into the emerging issues account by 400,000. So instead of 439,000 in the new emerging issues account, there'd be 39,000. 400,000 would be used for this project.
Okay. Mr. Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to echo again what Representative Eklund indicated. I have met a number of times, most recently 2 weeks ago, with folks from the Mille Lacs Band, and there is certainly not agreement on all aspects of how we need to preserve wild rice. It's interesting that DNR Commissioner Harrington from the Mille Lacs Band and his team, we actually met some people I hadn't seen in a long time because we've been working at the local level on some issues with wild rice at the outlet of Mille Lacs Lake and south through Onania in that watershed, and we actually got some things done there. Unfortunately, we continue to be limited by funding to make actual on-the-ground restoration efforts. So, I guess the end result of that meeting is we certainly identified areas we disagreed on, but we certainly do share that common interest in really getting out here and getting after pragmatic improvements to how we deal with wild rice beds in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, so back to the A3. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment's adopted. Next, I have the A6. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is on page 25 relating to the scientific and natural areas. And similar to discussions the committee's had in the past, it appears that there is a no net gain portion of this that was included on this appropriation only. And so I would like to remove that qualifier that is on page 25 and 26. And I move the A6 amendment, and I'd ask for a roll call.
Sure. Jim Heitzman.
I would ask members not to accept this amendment. I like the provision. I think that it's important that we vote our conscience on this and folks can consider what they would like to do.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay, so roll call been requested. The chair votes no.
Heinzman?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Acker?
No.
Becker Finn?
Yes.
Bliss?
No.
Clark? Eklund?
Yes.
Fisher?
Yes.
Green?
No.
Hoppe?
Yes.
Hornstein?
Yes.
Johnson, Brian?
No.
Johnson, Clark?
Yes.
Lehman?
No.
Lewick?
No.
Metza? Neuberger?
No.
Poston?
No.
Sundin?
Yes.
Switzinski?
No.
Torkelson?
No.
Uglum?
No.
Wagenius?
Pass.
There being 13 nays and 9 ayes, the amendment is not adopted. A9, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know during the walkthrough it was mentioned about wastewater treatment, and I know wastewater treatment is a very important issue for folks. However, earlier
or I guess it was in December, I recently received the Willard Munger Award, and so I read the biography of Willard Munger, and there was a section in there about the creation of the lottery and the Environmental Trust Fund. And there was quite a bit of discussion about, and maybe Representative Wagenius remembers this, there was quite a bit of discussion about whether it was appropriate to use the lottery funds, the Environmental Trust Fund, for wastewater treatment. And looking at the actual constitutional language, it does say loans may be made of up to 5% of the principal of the fund for water system improvements as provided by law. But I think that subdivision 11 goes farther than that. I think it opens up the trust fund in an interesting and creative way to wastewater treatment, which in the future I think would lead to wastewater infrastructure eating up most of the lottery funds. And I don't think that's what the lottery was for. I go back to the main author, Willard Munger, back in the 90s. And so I would move the A9 amendment and ask for a roll call.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I make two entirely different points about Representative Hansen's amendment, which I am going to vote for. One of the things that we had a lot of discussion about in LCCMR was the need for money for wastewater treatment. And PFA testified to us that what we needed this year for wastewater treatment or in the bonding bill would be $167 million. And there was clear worry that we wouldn't have enough money, yet the governor did put into his bonding recommendation $167 million. Good for the governor that we are moving forward on getting the job done. So the governor has kind of taken the issue off the table, as far as I'm concerned, and doing wastewater treatment in the right way with bonding dollars. So that's one issue. The other thing I wanted to mention is that the Constitution does allow for loans. It very specifically does allow for loans. The question is that smart or not? And in this case, maybe back when the Constitution was written, the loans might have been a good idea or an idea that was workable because of the relationship of interest rates then. But things are different now. The trust fund is probably making 6 or 7% a year, and we would be loaning out money at 1 or 2%. So common sense says, hey, wait a minute. Let's use bonding dollars instead, and besides, the governor put them on the table. So there's this common sense, practical reason that we shouldn't be doing the loans, even though they're constitutionally permitted. But on the other thing, the grants portion, which is on line 26.28, gets to grants. The Constitution does not allow for grants. And I think this part of the bill is unconstitutional because the Constitution very clearly defined what could be done and did not say that this was something that could be done. So for that reason, members, I would, for those three reasons actually, that the governor's put enough money on the table, interest rates are low right now, much lower than the money we are earning, the money we would put out would be, we'd only be getting about 1 or 2% back, yet the interest that we're getting on the lottery dollars now is maybe 6%. And the third reason is that the Constitution does not provide for grants. So I am going to be voting with Representative Hansen, and I think that everybody should.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wagenius.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about this. As the bill author and as the House member who serves as chair for the LCCMR, there was quite a robust discussion about this issue as we went through the proposal. And I think I would first like to kind of go to the issue of how. Of course, that is a significant question because the Constitution does allow for up to 5% to be used on this, but at the same time, it doesn't specifically spell out how. So as commissioners, we grappled with that, and that's part of the reason that we have the language before us today. And to the next sort of interesting point or comment that is being made, this is the second time I've carried the LCCMR bill. This is the second time I've had this bill to this committee. And each time there has been changes suggested as we have been going through that process today. There's been a number of amendments already, and changes have been suggested. And in some cases, some of those changes were adopted, in which case there was another old discussion around the idea of changing what had been the recommendations of 17 commissioners, at least a majority of 17 commissioners, and that the legislature, at least it was suggested, the legislature shouldn't necessarily be meddling with those suggestions, those arguments. And I just think it's interesting that here we are, and some of the same folks that have made those arguments are proposing changes today. I don't think that's bad. I think that the legislature does have a role in this process and a responsibility to consider changes as they come to us as representatives. So, and this may surprise you, Representative Wagenius, but I think that we should seriously consider Representative Hansen's amendment. I think as members we should decide maybe how this would affect our districts, and people maybe want to continue this debate as we go through this process. And so as the author of the bill, I would encourage members to seriously consider accepting the amendment.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the mechanics of a loan process through PFA. And I'm not sure who can answer this, perhaps fiscal staff, but if 5% of the corpus is going to be used as a revolving loan fund, is that going to be a constant revolving fund established with PFA, or will, as loans paid back, will the money be refunded to the corpus?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think that remains to be seen and have to be worked out with PFA. These are asking for recommendations for the future years of spending for this purpose. I think PFA had testified that it might be easiest in one of their current programs, so it could be structured either way. I believe the 5% would be a ceiling for the maximum amount that could be used as an investment tool within the corpus of the trust fund at any given point. So it wouldn't be necessarily 5% per year, but 5% of the value would be kind of a maximum that could be used as a tool. Right now, I believe the trust fund is invested like 70% mimics the S&P 500, 28% bonds, and 2% cash on hand. So it would be in that asset allocation somehow.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding correctly, if this should become law, PFA could access up to 5% of the corpus any time in the future and loan it out or not?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I don't believe so. Right now, this is just asking the legislature to make recommendations for future years.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. It sounds like there's a little uncertainty here as to just how the impact of this, and I wonder if we should be. Maybe I'm just uncertain. I don't know. But it's a little confusing for me, but we'll see how this amendment turns out.
Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, it sounds like you might be voting with me. I think, Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman, this issue comes up with a number of these funds, and the question on appropriations and recommendations of appropriations, if you may remember last year on Outdoor Heritage, I moved to spend some money on Emerald Ashport. So there have been proposed changes, I think, on both sides of the aisle. I think the question that comes in on something like this is mission creep in terms of moving from appropriation recommendation, which is the statutory charge of various groups, to policy. and making policy changes. So the amendment that we previously had on that no net gain was incorporated into an appropriation. That is putting a rider, that is putting a policy rider onto something. And here we have a portion of this recommendation that I think is clearly unconstitutional. But it's recommended by the group. Recommended. So I think as legislators who we attest to the Constitution when we're sworn in, we have that role. If something is not constitutional, or Representative Torkelson, if we have great doubt in terms of how this would actually work, I think that is appropriate for the legislature to remove policy that's tying the hands of the appropriations.
Further discussion on the A9. Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to add to the information here, as regards Representative Wagini has mentioned that the governor's recommended $167 million for bonding for wastewater facilities. The Legislative Water Commission has also agreed to that, I believe, with consensus, and so supports that $167 million.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay. To the A9 amendment, roll call vote has been requested. Chair votes yes.
Heintzman.
Yes.
Hansen.
Yes.
Thacker.
Yes.
Becker Finn.
Yes.
Bliss. Clark.
Yes.
Eklund.
Yes.
Fisher.
Yes.
Green.
Yes.
Hoppe.
Aye.
Hornstein.
Yes.
Johnson. Brian.
Yes.
Johnson. Clark.
Aye.
Lehman.
Yes.
Lewick.
Yes.
Metza. Neuberger. Poston.
Yes.
Senden.
Yes.
Swidzinski.
Sure.
Torkelson.
Aye.
Ugram.
Yes.
Wagenius.
Yes.
There being 21 ayes and 0 nays, the A9 amendment is adopted. Next. Yep. Next, to the bill. Representative Heintzman. As amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Nash is going to be presenting this bill in the Senate shortly, so I'll be very brief. I would ask members to move forward with the bill as amended.
Okay. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple things I wanted to comment on. First, I just wanted to give a shout out to the University of Minnesota and all the really innovative, good projects that are in here. You know, as you go through the list, it really is incredible. So when we talk about supporting the U of M, these are the kind of things that we're supporting when we do that. And then, you know, I think in the past, you know, last year there was a lot more tinkering with this bill, and so I'm happy that we're able to really push the recommendations of the commission forward, because it's problematic when we let politics get involved in a process that really has been a good process for us. You know, it's a good commission, it's bipartisan, it's, you know, citizens are truly involved in this process, and I think it's important that we respect that. So a lot of good projects in here. I was also really happy to see some projects that were maybe taken out for political reasons in the past now being included. So, you know, if these projects are being recommended year after year by the commission, I think it's important that we respect that. So thank you.
Okay, so I will renew my motion to move House File 3352 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. As amended. Yep, thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is passed. To Ways and Means. I think we have an agreement on with Representative Fisher's 3908. Would you care to address that for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not available to come back tonight because of religious services, so I talked to the committee administrator, and I'm fine with us coming back after break and then scheduling it at that point in time.
Okay. Very good. Anything else for the benefit of the group? We're adjourned.